This is a Gathering History Project podcast recorded in the Louth County Museum in Dundalk, Ireland.
Good afternoon and welcome along to another one of the Gathering History broadcasts. And this time we're turning the mic around and we're going to focus on one of Dundalk's best known characters. Good afternoon, Mr. Harry Lee.
Good afternoon, Jason. And nice to be the other side of the microphone, not under any pressure.
So, Harry, as part of this project, we're asking people about their roots in Ireland, Dundalk, their work in life, their background, their education, and their view of Ireland in the 21st century. So let me start off by asking you, Harry, where and when were you born?
Well, I suppose everyone hears me talking about Hill Street over the years, but I actually wasn't born in Hill Street. And that will probably, be a minus to me. But around 9 months of age, we went up to Hill Street. I was born actually in Mary Street North. And we moved up to Hill Street, I can't remember it, of course, to a house, just the first house on the, if you're going over Hill Street Bridge and the Falsha Guest House, in just the very, very first house in Hill Street, behind the railings there, that was the first house we were born in, and we were there, that I was born in, and then across the road, sorry, that was the first house we lived in Hill Street, and then just across the road, we moved across the road to a much younger house. It was only about 200 years old, I think, but the other one was about 400 years. But it was, I don't know why we moved there, but we moved there, and I was there up until, my mother, until we got married and everything. We were all born and reared in two bedrooms.
Okay, and your memories of growing up in Hill Street, Harry, had a happy childhood?
Yeah, I can't remember not being happy. My mother died when we were very young. I was only four. And there was two children younger than me. And it was one of these unfortunate situations at the time that people in those days didn't tell you anything about why your mother died, what was wrong with her, what she died of. And right up until my father died, even on his deathbed, I remember sitting down talking to him and asking him to talk to me about my mother. She was from Navan. I can't ever remember. My only memory that I have of we called her my real mother was when, to this day, which is now 70 years ago, and I can still remember it, been taken out of the hall to the people next door. And I looked in the front room and I saw the lid of a coffin up against the wall. And I hadn't a clue what it was at the time, of course, you know. But I know now that we knew nothing. We weren't at the funeral. We were nothing. And then we had a lady used to come in looking after us when my father went to work. He still had to go to work. He worked in the railway as a permanent, on the permanent way, which means fixing what do they call the things to stop the train? Signals. That was his main job. And this woman was mining us, a wonderful woman called May Jones. She was from out the RD Road. And she would come in every morning and mine us. And my father then went to work. And all of a sudden then, and to this day we don't know how long it was that he got married again. But we didn't know anything at all about it. And we were all washed and clean and put sitting down on a forum, as we called it, in the kitchen. And my father came in with this lady called Alice. And she gave each of us a bar of Cadbury's chocolate, the wee narrow 3-penny bars. And that was the introduction that we got to our stepmother. Now, you hear all the rumours, of course, about stepmothers and the stories about how bad and everything, but we probably had the best stepmother in the world. She was a wonderful, wonderful person. Worked in Orkey O'Neill, not in Orkey O'Neill's brother's house, as a cook from she was 14, down next door to the Gaelic League Hall in Seatown Place. And she was a member of the O'Neill family nearly. You know, she lived with them and everything. And she actually went out with my father during the time she was there. They were thinking about getting married. This is not what we've been told, and he broke up with her. He was transferred to Navan, where he met my real mother, Mary, and he got married to her and had six children practically 1 year after the other. And it was a great story. When she died, he went back, and she was advised by everybody, particularly the O'Neill family, don't go up there, Alice. There's six kids up there, you know, in a wee house. And she was living in a mansion down there, you know. But she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. Lived until she was 84. And brilliant woman.
Very good. And I'd be interested in knowing how you spent your time in Hill Street as a child. You know, kids nowadays have all this technology and toys and bits and pieces. When you were 7 or 8 or, you know, even younger than that, how did you spend your days?
Well, I suppose they down the Rampart River, which was very close to us, catching pinnigans. Do you remember them?
Yeah.
We spent many's a good afternoon down there up in Ladywell. Great place for courting.
That was a bit older.
There was so much area out by we used to go way up the Prowland, which was wonderful fields and everything up there where the Alzheimer's Birches is, away up there to the top of the field and away up to a place called Rosie's Avenue for picking blackberries. And their things, football, of course, from I was a young chap, was a great part of my whole life. And I was never any good at it. And everything I put my hand to, I was never any good at it. And I would have loved acting. I could not act, but I loved walking front of house. Football, I could not play football, but I loved being the fella at the side shouting at them to come on, do something that I couldn't do anyway, you know. I was always very much involved in Oriel Park as regards going up to see matches, minor matches and stuff like that, you know. Even down to what, there was a little shop in, now why or how anyone would want to open a shop in Hughes's Park. There was only about 40 houses in it, and there was a man called McCabe, and he had a wee shop in his front room. And I got a job with him going up to the games in Oriel Park and going round the inside of the pitch. The pitch was the opposite way to it is now, of course, selling wee bars of chocolate and stuff like that. And my pay would be to get a bar of chocolate and get into the match for nothing.
Very good. Were you ever in trouble as a child, or were you one of these people that the garrows never came to the door?
No, my father always had the old saying, of course, you know, we don't want the guards ever to come to our door. No, we never were that type. We were very, very innocent. I mean, you played football on the streets. We went, as I said, all the different things that we did that I've already told you about. You know, particularly in our teenage years, and going to the odd picture matinee would have been a big thing. We never had much money, but my mother, my stepmother, was a wonderful, wonderful cook. She could make a dinner out of anything, you know, and that was a great help to us. But no, I was, I suppose one of the biggest regrets that I have in my whole life would have been the job I took up.
Before you, I'm interested in knowing, just moving on from your childhood, do you think the fact that you went to the Fiery School and it was a strict school that kind of kept you on the straight and narrow?
Yeah, the Fiery School was a very strict school with some of the teachers. You know, some of the teachers were very nice, and I have not great memories of the Friary, or any schooling for that matter, because I do think back about my mother. You know, my father was only, as I say, a labourer, and he earned very little money, and yet we went over there some mornings absolutely terrified, because my poor mother couldn't give us all the money for books the one morning, and she would give us it one each week, or as much as she could get, you know. But the teachers couldn't understand that. They had good money, and they didn't give a damn where we were getting the money, and we were walloped for it. And there was some teachers that were absolutely awful for that. That was something that never went out of my, and any time I ever did interviews with school teachers, they were the things I always took up. Were they not guilty about something that they did? And if you remember, we did a brilliant interview one time with Seamus Tiernan, who was a retired teacher in the Friary, and he did say he regrets some of the things that he did. I just wonder, did the rest of them do it?
So where did you go to after you left Friary?
Oh, I went where most fellas went to spend 2 years, which was down to the Tech in Chapel Street, and just beside the Christian Brothers there, the one in the corner. And that was 2 years of dosing. I don't know what we did in it. I can't remember, other than one or two of the teachers. But they were 2 years of nothing, to be honest and truthful with you. And the next thing after that, then, I worked part-time in Late Shoe Shop, in where Donald McCardle's shop used to be. That used to be a wee shop.
How did you get in there?
Somebody told me there was a job going in for a messenger boy, and I went down and I got the job as a messenger boy. And I would go in the morning before I went to school and take down the big gates that was up on the front of it, wash the windows, light the fire. There was a fire, a real cold fire there, and all the girls that were, there was about three girls working in the shop, and they would have their coats on them until I got the coal and everything up and light the fire. And then away to school down in the Tech. That was in 1955. And my father got me a job as an apprentice mechanic out in Connolly's garage on the Newry Road. He knew somebody that was there, and all excited one day I went home and from work as a messenger boy, and he told me he got this job for me, and I wouldn't go. I said no, I wanted to work in a shop because it was lovely and clean, and I didn't tell him that, but I could see being all dressed up and, you know, maybe everyone fancying me and everything like that. Not that I had any money, but just that I looked well. But I refuse to take the biggest mistake in my life.
Okay, so you started off as a messenger boy in Leitz, and this was when you were still at school. So you would
you would
get the shop set up and then go back to work. Was it in the evenings?
From 4 to 6 then in the evening. Yeah.
Okay. So
and all day Saturday.
So how long did you spend in Leitz?
Well, I spent quite a few years because the late Petey Logan. Petey was the salesman in the shop, and anyone that knows anything about singing, of course, will know all about Petey Logan. Petey was a very, very good friend of mine, and Petey left to go into the ESB as a salesman. His father worked in the ESB, and like McCardle Mears and all of these, if your father worked somewhere, you would get it. But Petey Logan said to me, don't take this job because they're asking me, would you, do you think, should they ask me to stay on and take his job? And I should have believed what Petey said, but I didn't. And as again, I thought I was a great fella, and big mistake.
Okay, but you did spend, the best part of your working career in a shoe shop.
I spent nearly all of my working life in shoe shops. And I went to England in the late 50s for about a year and a half. And I was working in Oxford Street in a shoe shop. And
the Oxford Street.
The Oxford Street, a shop called Manfield's, and staying in a flat in Hornsey Rise, a real Irish North London. And but I stayed there for about a year and a half, and then I decided I come home, and I came home then, and I met then Franny in the Gaelic. I went and joined the Gaelic League.
Just before you move on to that, when you were working in England, how were you received in England?
At that time, with no problem, because that was before the Troubles or anything, of course, I had no problem at all. I can remember, and you're talking now about, 50 years ago more, and I can remember Mr. Timms was the name of the manager. I seem to have been followed around by a peculiar kind of men, because there was a fella there that I think he fancied me as well. I think everywhere I went, somebody fancied me. But I remember him as well. I'm only joking about the fellas, but he was a wee bit gay, and he wasn't a wee bit gay, he was gay, but we didn't know at the time what what gear was. But I remember him. So I remember it had a good impact on me. I learned a lot in it, you know. And
what was your, how much were you earning at that time?
I can't remember, Jason, but the only time that I can remember money was, and I'll tell you about it just in a wee second, but when I came back that time I got back into Leitz for a while when I came back from England. And I was, as I said, I went to the Gaelic League. We used to do Irish dancing there. Then I met Franny, and in 1963 we got married. But at that time, like, Franny had no job. They were after been letting people go. She worked in Connolly's shoe factory, and they were after letting people go from there. So we went away to England immediately. The day we got married, we went on a plane to Bristol over to Franny's sister. And we stayed there for the first 2 years of our married life in a caravan, on a caravan site.
How romantic.
Oh, in Weston-super-Mare. And they were in Franny's sister was in it. But these were beautiful big they were permanent caravans, you know. And I was then, I went to work in another shoe shop over there. And then I got a job as an area manager with this particular, the British Shoe Corporation. And my job was to travel around the whole southwest, Cornwall, Devon, down as far as Plymouth, Southampton, all there, as a relief manager. If somebody got sick, I was on call, and I was sent for, and that went on for about 2 years. I loved that.
So you didn't miss Ireland at all when you were...
Not at that time, no, I didn't, no. Franny did. She never settled in England, never. We went then, and I got a job in as manager of a shop in Newbury in Berkshire. And we had a flat over the shop, and Patrick was born there. And we came home, Patrick was born in December. We came home in 1964. He was born in 63. In 1964, we came home, and Franny wouldn't go back. She hated going back, and she wouldn't go back.
So that was you permanently back?
I had to go back and tidy up all the things that I had to do, the loose ends, and give them a month's notice and everything. But when I came back, before I came back, I was buying the Irish papers to see was there any jobs. And there was a job going in Arnott's for a shoe salesman. And I applied for that and went home, flew home, and went for the interview in Arnott's of Henry Street with a brilliant man that, well, I thought he was brilliant. Everyone else hated the sight of him, but I'd gone like a house on fire with him. A man called Mr. Golden from Galway, who was the shoe manager. And I got the job. I travelled up and down every day for 3 years. And after about a year and a half, they opened a new shop in Grafton Street. And I was asked to go up and be assistant manager to this lady who was there in Arnott's nearly all her life, and I had to give her the job of manager. But I was called in and by Mr. Golden and said, "Now look, Mr. Lee, they always call you, you know, we are sending you up here. You officially, as far as anyone else knows, is assistant manager, but you are really the manager, and we will pay you manager's wage." I just loved that shop. And a good reason would have been, of course, that it was all a lady shop. No men shop, nothing in the men's end of it. And there was 77 staff in it. And there was three men. Myself, the manager, he was from Monaghan, a man called Mr. Dagnan, and a storeman. And that was it. So we had a great time. I'm only joking, we hadn't a great time. But I loved it. It was brilliant. It was an absolutely brilliant place to work.
Well, Harry, that begs the question that you must have been really good at your job. You must have, if there were only three men and 77 women, you must have been really good at doing your job.
I was one of these fellas, I suppose, Jason, if I'm honest, that I I was no trouble to any of them. I would do, and I like people. I always got on well with people. And the big thing with Arnott's was when I gave them my notice that I was leaving, because I got back to Leeds. I went back to Leeds. There was a job advertising the Democrat for, and I had in Arnott's £14 a week in 1968. And I was going up and down in the train, buying me dinner in Dublin, paying £2.50 a week in Cox's Domain for our house. I was one of the very first people into Cox's Domain, number 54, and when it was built. But they did not want me to leave, and they even offered to give me money towards a flat for to stay in Dublin rather than be travelling up and down. But Franny wouldn't move to Dublin, so I had to come back. And I came back to Leeds for exactly the same money that I had in Dublin, and I thought I was a millionaire.
Okay, so that was in 1968?
In March of 1968.
Tell me what Dundalk was like in 1968.
Well, 1968, it wasn't bad. The Troubles weren't really started big at that time. They really didn't start about a year after that, you know. But it was a busy, I mean, if you consider, Leeds had two shops, and they turned, the three shops all together in Clonbrass Street. One up, the one I was, where Donald McCardle was, and the others was down, do you know where that shop is down at the moment? They have stands out in the street selling stuff and everything, way down the bottom of Clonbrass Street. That's where Leeds was. And they had two separate shops there, and they turned them into one. They spent a fortune on it. It was reopened in 1970, one of the most modern shops in Dundalk. You know, so there was money around at that time. Like, you know, they weren't bad times. The 70s weren't bad.
And just to describe what it was like to shop in Dundalk on a Friday or a Saturday.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, you look down Clonbrass Street now at 12 o'clock of a Saturday, and you'd be lucky if you saw one car. And I mean one car. That is not the way shopping is done now. Of a Saturday, we would be open at 9 o'clock, and we would be busy all day long. Saturday was the big day, and the crowds in Clonbrass Street, up and down and up and down, non-stop. And it really was, when you consider now, there was no shopping centres, of course, at that time. It was all shops, ordinary shops, you know. But these were great businessmen, you know. A lot of them were Protestants. Like, Leeds were Protestants, and you know, there was an awful lot. Melbourne's and the fish shop, Stewart's, all of these people. But they were good employers. There was nothing wrong. But the only trouble was that it is any kind of shoe or retail, you'll never make money in it, because it's Mickey Mouse money you're paid in it, you know. But I was quite happy there.
So was that one of the reasons then you choose to take on your own shop and move into your own
place? No, the wee story about that was, I went back to Leeds in 1968, and I stayed there until the bomb went off in 1975 in Crow Street. And Petey Logan owned a little sweet shop at the corner of the town hall, which he used to have open at night when the concerts would be on and all that kind of thing in the town hall. And when the bomb went off in Crow Street, across the road from the shop, it blew the shop to smithereens. And Petey then, his mother, who was quite an elderly woman, her and another friend of hers used to run the shop. But they got a bit old, and they didn't want to build it up, have it built up again and start off again. So Petey came down to me one day and he asked me, look, what do you think of a wee shoe shop there? Would it go? And I said, well, shall we give it a try? And we gave it a try. So in February of the following year, 1976, we opened a place called the Shoe Boutique, spelt B-O-O-T-I-Q-U-E. Really. And it went very, very well. Not only that, but up where Stapleton Court is, the back of the old Dundalk Shopping Centre, where the flower shop is there, we actually expanded and we opened a second shop. And it was opened by Mike Murphy and the late Kevin Moran. They officially opened that wee row of shops. And, of course, like everything else, all the shop, practically every one of the shops has closed. There's none of the shops. Carlisle Park is still there, I think. They came in after us. I don't think there's any of the shops lasted very long up there. It wasn't a good spot.
So, at the point where you had two shops.
Yeah.
Business sounded as if it was good. Dundalk, at that point, this is before the 80s, late 70s, was a busy place.
Yeah.
How did you find running a business?
Well, what happened was it was just one of these things that the biggest problem that we had was that, now, when, let me just, before I answer that question, we decided after about a year, we had the shop for a year, and we decided that after a year, it wasn't worth it. We were not losing money, but we weren't making money, so it wasn't worth it. So we closed that place. But then Petey then wanted for to get out of it. Petey didn't had no interest in it. He was too busy in his job and everything. So therefore, we changed then the name of the shop from the shoe boutique to Harry Lee Shoes. And we used the slogan, of course, I used the slogan, which was the one from the EBS, yes, 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 at the EBS. But instead we said, yes, 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 at the HLS was Harry Lee Shoes. And we did a lot of advertising with Ray Stone on Telstar Radio, which were brilliant times. And it was going very, very well. And like I was making not a fortune, but I was surviving. And but the next thing then, this is around the time that the supermarkets, like Dunn Stores, Penny's, started getting shoes in. I remember going up to Dunn's and buying Wellingtons in Dunn Stores in Park Street and take them down, and I could sell them. I could buy them cheaper than I could off the retailers, or the wholesalers rather. So in 90, I then started getting into trouble now. And these years, the years from 1987 to the middle of 1988, and they were when I don't know how I survived. Never told no one. Never told Franny or the kids or nothing. They were still looking for the money for to go to the discos. And don't ask me, Jason, I really genuinely do not know where or how I got the money. I often think, laying in bed at night, thinking, where did I get the money? Because those days I took nothing in, you know. And I remember, anyone that knows me will know this story about me waiting on the postman to come for that the bills wouldn't go to the house that I would get it off at St. Alphonsus Road. And I knew if I was up there about 9:15 in the morning, I would see him. And but this as I say, I told none of them about anything. But this particular time, we were behind in the mortgage, behind in the ESB, behind in everything that was possible to be behind. And I went up to see the postman this particular morning, and the postman was off sick, and there was another chap was doing his round, and he went the opposite way, and he came in through Green Acres, and I was sitting in the car above at St. Alphonsus Villas, and the letters arrived at the house. And that was a really, really tough time. And I know that we had to get a loan of, I remember it as well, 700, and I think it was £15, to punt, I think it was at that time. And we had to get in the train and go up to Dublin with that money to the Building Society before that 5 o'clock that evening. And I got a loan of that money. And they were very, very tough times.
So when the point came where you said, okay, I'm going to close up the shop, you know, and Franny knew and the family knew and all that, did it come as a relief to you?
Yes. Once I told them, I closed the shop on the 16th of August 1988 at 1 o'clock. And they had known about that. But I went home. On the way home, I don't know what happened, But I said, I'm not going back there. And I didn't. I closed up the shop and I never went back to the shop. And the late Tony McDonald, Tony, a very good friend of mine, and it was, as I say, August, and a couple of people actually were very, very good to me. Constance Short, the arts officer in Dundalk, who I did part-time work for, she called me and said, look, I have a little job, might be, you know, something for you, there'd be a few quid in it. And my job was to go in when the school kids would come up from school to the town hall and switch on the television for to put something, it was the Spanish Armada or something, and they were all studying it that year, and that was my job there. I did that for 2 weeks, I remember. I also remember, and I always, and I have no problem saying this, up until he retired from being a TD, I always voted for him for it, and that was Brendan McGann. Brendan McGann was the only person that came out to my house and rapped at the door at 11 o'clock one night and told me about a job that he had got me out in Greenore at the boats, in the office at the boats, counting pallets coming off the. I didn't take him up on it now, to be honest with you, but I always remember Brendan McGann for that. But Tony McDonald then gave me a job in the shop, in Tony McDonald's shop, for until Christmas, and that took me over Christmas, and I was working 3 days a week there and getting money on the dole as well. And just after Christmas then, the manager of Connolly's shoe shop, which is where Levy's glasses shop is, there used to be Connolly's shoe shop, he had a bad accident. And I got a call from E.J. Connolly to see would I go in and take over the shop. He never came back. That man never came back to his job. And that was a man's only shop. That was I enjoyed a couple. I was there for, I'd say, a couple of years. And then I suppose then you could say I was kind of all over the place then for a while. And Desi Dunn, Lord of Mercy and Desi. Desi opened a shop up where Des O'Loughlin's shop is in Park Street now. And he asked me, would I leave Connolly's to go up there to him, which I did. And unfortunately, it never worked out at all. It was just not the right place for a shoe shop. And there was no passing business or anything like that. And that I retired then from that. And I went in then to Larry Hannerty in Tlebrassa Street. When he heard that I was leaving, he offered me a job there. And I stayed there until 2002.
Okay.
I stayed there. But of course, during that time was the probably the most harrowing year of my life, was when Franny was very ill, and that was a full year that she was practically a full year in Beaumont, and never came home from the day she went in. And I went up and down every day except Saturday. Caroline used to go up and down every Saturday. That was to see her deteriorating from what she was before she went into the hospital, and to see 11 months later the way that she deteriorated had a terrible effect on us all. And you know, I remember the Friday night that Dr. Connolly sent her into the Louth when she wasn't feeling too well. She and Caroline and myself took her up that evening actually to the outpatients, and she was sitting above saying, well, I don't know what I'm in here at all. I feel grand now. It was just this morning I wasn't feeling great, you know. And I can see her now to this day with the nurse saying, you're next now, Mrs. Lee, come on ahead. And she walked down that corridor and she never came home. And that was a very, very tough time, just to see what she went through during that time, you know. But the big help to me in all of that then was, of course, when the radio came about. Because when I went back to work after Franny died, 2 weeks after she died, I knew I'm not going to stay here. This is the few years I have left. I'm not going to stay here. And Joe Martin came into the shop one day and told me that there was a new radio station starting in town. And they offered him a program, and he didn't want to go on his own. And he asked me, would I go up with him? And sure, I went up with him. And one thing led to another then. And eventually, about 6 months later, I got a full-time job in it.
So let me just ask you about that. Anybody who's listened to you on the radio, or anybody seen you front of house in the town hall in Dundalk, or anybody seen you in connection with any of the players or anything like that, would have said, oh, shit, that was obvious. Harry was always going to move into media or entertainment or whatever it might be. Why do you think it took you so long to kind of make the connection?
Fear of, and having five kids, and I would have loved to have got a job in the town hall front of house as paid manager, but I wasn't paid. We were all there for all those years. I started in 1975 in the town hall, and you would get a few quid if the groups did well, you know. And then somebody like Paddy Craven's group, Paddy would take you out for a meal. But sure, the whole thing was crack, you know. Then, of course, the town hall, which was really part of my life, and like no one knows how much I loved what I was doing. People couldn't understand how I just loved what I was doing. Tried on the stage one time? No. I made up my mind very quickly, this is not for you, you know. And Trevor now is taking over, because Trevor's a very good actor. He's in rehearsing a play at the moment. But I was hopeless, absolutely hopeless. But I loved the front of house. Then when they did it in Hall Up, which was a complete disaster, of course, and the worst thing that was ever done in this hall is, or this town, was what they butchered the town hall and would not listen to any of us. We all told them what they're doing is wrong, and they would just not listen to us. And we were people like, I'm talking about people like Matt Murphy, Stephen Burns, all of these people, including the boys front of house and everything. We told them, this is wrong. What you're doing is completely wrong. And now we have a town hall down there that nobody comes to. All the big acts like Brendan Grace and all the acts that we personally, myself and Petey Logan, took them to the town hall. People like Val Dunigan and Frankie Vaughan, Vince Hill, Andy Stewart, even though he's a Rangers supporter, we give him an awful time that night. But all of these people, there's none, acts are not coming to the town hall now, other than the pantomime and the musical society and acts like that, you know.
So let me finish up by asking you about your time in the radio. And people have said you were born to be in the radio. You have that kind of eclectic voice. You have that personality to be able to pull information out of everybody. It seems effortless to you, and on a good day you get a ding-dong argument or a very touching interview. Which did you enjoy more?
There's a few of them that I love politics. I look at politics on television all the time, and I'm not even talking about Irish politics. I would watch now in the mornings Leader's Question Time. And I would then turn it over to Sky to watch David Cameron, in the House of Commons. And I would then go back over and watch the news. And so I love that kind of stuff. I just loved, my favourite whole thing was the time of the 2007 general election. And there was 12 candidates went up for election here in Louth. And I got 11 of them on the stage in the town hall, live with an audience. And we went out and did a 2.5 hour programme live. And I remember Mairead McGuinness from Fine Gael saying to me when I rang her up to say, well, Harry, you're mad in the head. I'm not interested. No, it can't work. That's an impossibility, you know. And the only way I could get her to come on it was to ring her up the day before and say, Mairead, I just want to tell you that I've got 10 of them coming. The only one that's not coming is Fergal O'Dowd And he wouldn't come any because it was all Drogheda. He's from Drogheda. But you'd need to come. And she came. And it was absolutely brilliant. And that was a great. But I love doing the Father Brian Darcy's. I love doing real sad ones about the young McCormick girl who was going for, she dying of cancer, and she went out to America. I think it was America, to get treatment. And came back and told me, sat down with me and told me all her story. And she died a couple of days after we talked to her. And I remember the mother coming up to me one day in Deli Lights. I was having a coffee. And her mother, who I never met, came up and said, "You don't know how much it meant to her to be able to go on and talk about." That's the kind of thing, you know. It was, I just loved anything. Anything. I'd be a nervous wreck before I went on, and people used to say with the papers, I'd be moving papers here and moving papers there, but I just loved what I was doing, and it was no bother to me.
And radio has a tendency to be, with all that seriousness and with all those heavy stories, you would have the odd moment of complete hilarity stuck in the middle of everything.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure one of those two, does any of them pop to mind that it was something that you just didn't see coming that happened on there?
Oh, yeah, there's no way. And when anyone asks me that question, I have no hesitation in telling which was Johnny Duffy. One of the banjo Duffys, and from Oliver Plunkett Park. And he worked in Foss for 35 years. And I rang him and said, would he come up? And the funny thing is, Jason, very few people refused to come on the radio with me. And that's what I loved about it, you know. People didn't mind coming on. I would never try and be smart or anybody or catch them or anything like that. I never, ever did that, and I wouldn't do that. But Johnny Duffy came on to talk about his 35 years down in Foss. Now, I'll have to cut this very short, but Johnny started the whole first hour of the programme, 50 minutes actually, he talked about growing up in Oliver Plunkett Park. We never even got as far as Foss. And it was the first time at the end of the interview that I had to say to him, "Johnny, will you come back next week and we'll talk about Foss?" And the one little story of that one was, Johnny told a story about his, he was off sick one day from school, and his brother was off sick, and the brother was upstairs in bed, and the mother was making a big pot of stew out in the kitchen. And in those, there was a huge family of them. I think there was 12 or 13 kids in that house. But she had a big, big, big pot, the biggest pot you could imagine, on the top of the gas stove. And there was two rings of gas to heat it. But anyway, when she had it all done, everything went into the stew, of course. Everything went into the pot, you know, stew. And she asked Johnny to give her a hand to put it down in the ground to cool. So the two of them lifted it off with the handles, puts it down in the ground, and the mother went out for to do it. And Johnny was in one of the other rooms, and as he came out, here he sees the young fellow was coming down the stairs, and the toilet was out the back, and he couldn't make the toilet, and he peed in the stew. And we were on the floor in the studio laughing at this. We couldn't, and now he was saying the right word, like, you know. And he went on to say, when my mother came in, I said, "Mammy, I have something to tell you. That old fella peed in the stew." And she walloped me for telling her, do you see? But the next thing was, anyway, she said, and Johnny says to me, "Now, Harry, you know yourself what you do if somebody pees in stew." And I said, "I don't, Johnny, honest to God, I don't." "You get the sacks of salt and you sprinkle it all over, and then the sacks of salt goes down into the, and takes the urine down." And he was so serious. And then they got the handle of a brush and they mixed it all up. And to finalise the story, he said that, "I'll give you two guesses who didn't eat stew in our house that night." Without any shadow of a doubt, Johnny Duffy. Yeah, brilliant, well, brilliant story.
Well, that's a good one. I think that's a good one to wrap it up on, Harry. I'm really looking forward to this project, and I hope we get more and more stories like that. And I suppose your final thoughts on what's in store for next year?
Yeah, well, we've already done a few of them, and I just love talking to people from Dundalk, anything about Dundalk. And we're looking for people that's coming home, even for a couple of days. They don't have to be coming for weeks or anything like that, you know. And if they would like to come down and have a chat with me about it, if they can't make it, I will take my recorder down to them, and then we can put it on the internet. But if anyone is listening to this and knows any friends or anything that is coming home from England, America, anywhere, and they would like to talk to us, and this will be history. We are making history here, because this is the gathering year. It's history, though. In years to come, these recordings will be available down here in the museum, and in 100 years' time, somebody will be listening to this recording to be saying, who the hell was Harry Lee? Help us make history by visiting our website on www.gatheringhistory.com.